Herzlich willkommen zu einer neuen Episode Forward Thinkers. Mein Name ist Daniel Fürk und mein heutiger Gast ist Mark Trachtenberg. Er gilt als einer der führenden Historiker für internationale Beziehungen und lehrte viele Jahre an der University of California in Los Angeles. In seinem aktuellen Buch Chronik eines angekündigten Krieges analysiert er gemeinsam mit dem Journalisten Markus Klöckner die politischen und diplomatischen Fehler, die seiner Ansicht nach zum Krieg in der Ukraine geführt haben. Trachtenberg vertritt dabei eine Sicht, die stark von der in Europa gängigen Analyse abweicht. Er sieht die Hauptschuld nicht in Moskau, sondern im Westen. In der NATO-Erweiterung, in verpassten Chancen nach dem Ende des Kalten Krieges und in einer Politik, die Russland gedemütigt habe. Besonders kontrovers ist seine Einschätzung, Donald Trump hätte den Krieg womöglich schneller beenden können. Eine These, die viele Experten und Expertinnen für unrealistisch halten. Gerade weil seine Argumente so streitbar sind, lohnt sich der Blick auf diese Perspektive. Ich wollte von ihm wissen, warum er den Krieg für vermeidbar hielt, wie er auf die aktuelle Diplomatie schaut und welche Lehren sich aus der Geschichte ziehen lassen. Wenn dir diese Episode von Forward Thinkers gefällt, folge uns bei Spotify, Apple Podcasts oder wo auch immer du gerne Podcasts hörst und hinterlasse uns eine gute Bewertung.
In an ever-changing world, we need to keep track of what will be next. Forward Thinkers is your 48 Forward podcast to discover the future. We are talking to innovative and creative minds from all over the world to learn more about what they are working on and what they think will change the way we work and live within the next decade. Are you ready to join the ride? Welcome to Forward Thinkers.
Dear Mark, I'm so glad that you are taking the time to talk with me about your book, about war, about politics, about diplomacy, about the situation in Ukraine, and everything else that is happening in a geopolitical way right now. Welcome to the show.
Well, thanks. It's wonderful to be here, Daniel. I've been looking forward to it. That's great.
If we are looking at the current situation in Ukraine, especially, we are seeing European leaders traveling to Washington to talk to Trump and support Zelensky. And we are seeing, like, I would call it maybe new ways of diplomacy or trying to set a new path for diplomacy in that whole situation. What do you think, if you look at everything that is happening right now, do you think there is an optimistic way to see everything that is going on right now? Or is it more or less like trying whatever it takes to find some way of ending this?
Well, if it's policy of doing whatever it takes to end the war, that policy is making progress, then that is an optimistic approach to these things. As you know, I'm a historian. I am a little uncomfortable about reading too much into what's been revealed to the public, because my whole experience studying history is that the picture that emerges when you get access to material that was secret at the time, but only becomes declassified like 30 years later, the picture that emerges is totally different from the way it seemed at the time. On the other hand, Trump is a very unusual politician, and he seems to kind of break all the rules. He doesn't particularly care about confidentiality and doing things behind closed doors, and he tries to be very, very open about what he's doing, much to the rage of a lot of people. Anyway, what we've learned about this Anchorage meeting and about what progress has been made towards settling this war is very interesting. It's like, it seems that this whole issue of security guarantees is on the verge of being settled. The Trump administration has spoke of NATO-like or Article 5-like security guarantees. It's hard to know exactly what to make of that, because for years now, Trump has said that the reason why you had the war is that the West insisted on admitting Ukraine eventually into NATO, and this was unacceptable to Russia, and therefore the West was responsible for causing the war. So how can you have effectively an agreement to take Ukraine into NATO or give Ukraine the same sort of security guarantees they can give the NATO states and have that be acceptable to Russia or even to Trump, given what he said? So you have the sense of there has to be a whole lot more there beneath the surface. The sort of thing they have in mind has to be different from NATO. We don't know what it is. We don't know too much about the other arrangements about transfer of territory. One of the things that's kind of surprised me is that there hasn't been much talk about plebiscites or referendums to redraw the borders in accordance with the wishes of the people in those areas, which is a way of giving whatever territorial transfers do take place a certain degree of legitimacy. So I like I say, I'm very reluctant to say that this thing is on the verge of being solved. It does seem that Trump has his heart set on getting a Nobel Peace Prize, and that he'll, without regard to any of these basic issues of what American policy should be, he just wants to kind of settle this conflict. And who knows? Who knows? You know what will happen? You know, the next few weeks, I think, should tell us a lot. And presumably, Trump has briefed the European leaders on what was agreed to there, and there'll be leaks from the European government. So we should be able to find out a bit more. But as I say, you're never quite sure what's going on behind the scenes.
So as you just mentioned, you are a historian and you studied the history of international relations extensively. If we are looking back at the past three decades, was that war truly kind of announced, or have there been moments when it could still have been prevented?
Well, it could have been prevented from the start if the West had pursued the sort of policy of doing whatever was necessary to help Russia make the transition to a market economy and therefore help Russia become a Western country and have a more democratic political system. In other words, to do with Russia the same thing that was done with Poland, the Czechs, the Slovaks, the Hungarians, and so on, especially also East Germany. There, the key failure on the part of the Western countries was to turn their backs on Russia and to say, oh, Russia's so weak now, we can do whatever we want, screw them. And this was a policy that was opposed at the time by a lot of the more thoughtful people in the West. Margaret Thatcher, for example, or the American NATO, American ambassador to the Soviet Union at the very end, his name was Jack Matlock. They wanted to pursue a more generous policy. And it was insane for us not to do it, because if only, I mean, all you have to do is look at all the money that we were saving in terms of military spending if Russia had made a successful transition to democracy and to a viable relationship with the Western countries. Those savings on the military side would more than finance the whatever it would have cost to help Russia make that transition. Right. So right away, that was the first error, a very basic error. Instead, we went the route of NATO expansion. The decision to expand NATO, regardless of what Russia thought, despite what were recognized as promises that had been made at the end of the Cold War by both Secretary of State, U.S. Secretary of State James Baker, and the German foreign minister at that time, Hans-Dietrich Genscher, in February 9th and 10th, 1990, to the effect that if Russia agreed to the inclusion of Eastern Germany in the Federal Republic and to the inclusion of the expanded Federal Republic in NATO, then that would be it. There would be no further expansion there. And knowing that these assurances had been given. The Western powers just moved ahead and did it anyway because the whole notion was, they're so weak, they can't do anything about it. Very, very foolish policy. So that decision was made by the Bush administration. People think, oh, it was only under Clinton that the NATO expansion policy was adopted. Not true. There's important historical work, especially by Josh Schifferson, that shows that the key decisions were made before Bush left office. Clinton, of course, renewed that policy and pursued NATO expansion, despite the fact that it was opposed by, I'd say, most members of the American national security establishment, the people out of office. George Kennan was the most important of them, but it wasn't just Kennan. These were even people who were pillars of the right wing of the national security establishment. Paul Nitzer, for example, against NATO expansion. It was done anyway with predictable consequences. Russians went along with it because they couldn't do anything about it. Putin tried to, when he took over after the turn of the century, he tried to mend fences with the United States. He took what was actually a courageous step for him, because a lot of people in the Russian elite opposed this, of siding with the Americans after the September 11th, 2001 attacks and helping. But instead of accepting the outstretched hand and working with Russians and paying due regard to Russian interests, Russian concerns, the Americans treated this as, oh, it's proof of weakness, he had no choice, that sort of thing. And so once again, the Western countries, led by the United States, but the Europeans were totally complicit in this, they pursued a policy of moving ahead, expanding Western influence, without regard to how the Russians felt about it. It was astonishing to me when I was about the European attitude. The Americans like throwing their weight around. America views itself as a great imperial power with interests all over the world. You know, Dean Acheson, Secretary of State under Truman, he said, the United States was the greatest imperial power the world has ever known. He said, the United States is the locomotive at the head of mankind, and the rest of the world is the caboose. You know what the caboose is? It's the part of the train that comes to the very end. It's not that every American thinks along those lines, but it's as though the Americans, after World War II, acquired a taste for empire and for throwing its weight around. I think a lot of U.S. support for NATO has to be understood in those terms. All right. So I thought, well, it's understandable that the Americans would feel that way, because this is, Americans, I know they have a taste for this kind of thing. Not everybody, maybe, but in the American national security establishment nowadays, I don't know, maybe 60, 70% of the people think in those terms. There's a minority, about 30%, that doesn't like this stuff at all. All right. What was surprising to me is that the Europeans, who I always thought of as more sophisticated and more attuned to power political realities than the United States was, not because they're intellectually superior or anything like that. It's like they have to, given their geopolitical position of being exposed, of being relatively weak, they have to think in terms of power. The Americans, they're so secure, they're so strong, they're so rich, they could afford to ignore these things. So I was over in Europe, and this was in Oslo, and there was a conference, this is about 10 years ago, sponsored by the Norwegian Nobel Institute. And the secretary of that institute was a historian, a Norwegian historian, he was a very good historian. His name was Geir Lundestad. And he gave this talk there, and he talked about the international consensus. The international consensus was the liberal consensus, expanding democracy, expanding human rights, expanding the rule of law, expanding market-based systems, expanding, the whole U.S.-led international order. This, he said, was an international consensus. I said, international consensus? When did they make this consensus up? It didn't include me, I thought. You say, you know, but what was of interest to me is that my generation was very leery of American involvement throughout the world. You know, we were burned by the whole Vietnam experience. It was younger people who had a taste for the liberal internationalist foreign policy. And it's like, so their world, not mine. You know, it's like they're going to, you know, the chickens, we have this expression in English, the chickens will come home to roost, you know, or with another expression, as you sow, so shall you reap. This thing is bound to have consequences. And, you know, and you think that you can, you know, just push ahead without regard to what other countries like Russia and China feel. Maybe you can right now. Maybe they're unusually weak right now, but they're big countries. They're full of talented people. They can create serious massive military power. You know, this whole sort of thing, especially American meddling in Ukraine, is going to have enormous consequences. I mean, was it foreseeable? It was foreseeable to people like Cannon in the 1990s. It was foreseeable to a lot of us who have some sense of how international politics works. You can't ride roughshod over the interests, the core interests of other countries without expecting there to be a reaction. And then when there is a reaction, people say, we had no way of knowing this. This is because these Russians are just such terrible people, and they're so intent on expanding, and Putin is a dictator, and dictators are bad, and you know all this kind of thing. They ignore the fact that this was not just predictable, but that it had been predicted by some very serious observers for years and years and years. So anyway.
So there might be critics out there who are listening to you and would object to that and say, like, an analysis like that kind of not ignores, but maybe doesn't take the irrationality, the aggression, and the very own Putin narratives on Russian history and how that nation has to become what it used to be in the future, doesn't take those aspects into account. You know, I could completely agree. If we would have someone on the other side who is very rational, very clear, very democratic, maybe also, and not aggressive at all. But if we look at everything we learned about Putin in the last decades and how he also became more and more aggressive, and if you look behind the curtain, you could also see that there is a whole narrative that has been promoted within the Russian society of how Russia has to become a great nation again. Basically, not that far from Make America Great Again, but the Russian version of it, and even more aggressive and even more kind of, delusional.
Well, let me first say this. If the United States and the other Western countries had pursued a more Russia-friendly policy from the start, from 1990 on, especially after the fall of the Soviet Union and Yeltsin coming to power in Russia, then it's practically inconceivable to me that someone like Putin would have ever even come to power. If Russia had been welcomed into the Western world, if we had pursued a very generous policy to them, if we had respected Russia as a great power with interests of its own and welcomed them into the international community, supported their transitions and so on, the whole situation in Russia would have been very different. Of course, it's impossible to prove anything like this. When you make arguments of that sort, you have to draw on a certain theory of how international politics works, how human affairs work. That being said, Putin does come to power. He has political support in Russia, not because he's a crazy person, but because the entire Russian elite, including the Democrats, felt like Russia had been treated like dirt, that its fundamental interests had been trampled upon. But I will say this in behalf of people who argue along those lines, and this relates to the events of this year. When Trump was elected, he said he can end the Ukraine war in a single day. And what he had in mind was, this war makes no sense. It was a result of policies that the West had pursued. Those policies can be abandoned. We can agree that that Ukraine should be neutralized like Austria was during the Cold War, and still is, by the way. And we could agree to territorial changes that reflect military realities as well as ethnographic considerations, especially with regard to Crimea. That's what Putin wants. He's a rational statesman. We give him that. He'll end the war. We can end the war immediately because it was the fault of the West. It was the fault of Ukraine. Right? So, not an absurd view, by the way. This is the famous political scientist, John Mearsheimer, in the United States. He had a famous article in Foreign Affairs, Why the Ukraine Crisis is the West's Fault. He gave a talk explaining why this was the case. 20 million views on YouTube. Unheard of for an academic. I thought Trump is willing to make these concessions. Europeans are all up in arms. How can you do this? What nerve they had bullying the Ukrainians? You know, what nerve they had the way Trump treated Zelensky when he was in the Oval Office. You know, the Europeans felt like, this is just a total outrage. We have to stand for principle and so on and so on. But Trump seemed willing to do it. And he always, from the start, wanted good relations with Russia, which, by the way, was why the national security establishment did everything it could to paralyze his first presidency, to undermine his first presidency with the Russia hoax. So I thought that they'll be able to wrap this thing up really fast. The Ukrainians would be told, look, you want any support at all, you got to agree to these terms. They would have no choice but to give way. The Europeans, they would have no choice but to accept it because they can't stand up to Russia on their own. Germany's a non-nuclear power. It's utterly dependent on the United States. They would have to accept it too. So I thought, this thing's going to be wrapped up really fast. And then, to my amazement, Putin starts raising the demands. He's unwilling to settle the conflict on what, to my mind, were very reasonable terms. Terms that Trump proposed, which he was attacked for in the West by the liberals for being an appeaser, for this being like Trump was like Neville Chamberlain and Putin was like Hitler, you know, all this kind of thing. Trump was willing to pay that price because he doesn't care about these establishments. As a matter of fact, I think he likes provoking them. And so I said, this thing is going to be ended quickly. But it wasn't. It wasn't rational because he has every interest in settling the war, not just to end the bloodshed, but to restore Russia's standing as a accepted member of the international community, to restore decent economic relations, to do away with these sanctions and, you know, all that sort of thing. Plus, if you want a decent relationship between the Russian people and the Ukrainian people, you obviously have to stop the fighting. You obviously need to pave the way for some reconciliation. So why continue the fighting? You're going to conquer all of Ukraine? You're going to occupy all of Ukraine? You're going to impose police state methods to control the Ukrainians? What, you know, all you have to do is start thinking through, you know, what the consequences are of not settling, to say Putin had this phenomenal interest in settling. You know, he has, in domestic political terms, he would have been treated as a great hero if he had settled. So I was very surprised, and it led me to think that the people will say, look, you don't understand, this guy is irrational, he's committed to this whole vision of a greater Russia, and blah, 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 blah. Maybe they have a point. Frankly, I don't know. And we will, because a lot of what's going on could be viewed as kind of bargaining terms, just maneuvering for better terms or whatever, or appeasing certain elements within his own national security establishment. I don't know. But basically, when you're grappling with these issues, you have to think through what the consequences would have been of alternative courses of action, what the consequences would be even today of alternative courses of action. And since you're dealing with things that never happened, you can't look at the historical record and say, well, we see this and we see that. You have to rely on a theory. And rhetoric, including rhetoric about certain interpretations of the historical unity of the Russian and Ukrainian people and all that sort of thing. Rhetoric, one thing I've learned as a historian, is that rhetoric cannot be taken at face value. Rhetoric exists for instrumental purposes. And so you have to be very wary making hard and fast judgments on the basis of people's utterances. So that's how I would answer people like that. Not that any of these issues are decided on the basis of rational debate, as you well know, I imagine.
Like my point of view, my very personal point of view, without being a historian, is there is a guy in Russia, Putin, and there's nothing he has to lose right now, basically. Like, you know, he's too old to have any more career steps, and there are also none available. But besides that, the only thing he could lose right now is power and his kind of life work. And there is so much to gain for him right now. The whole world is looking at him, pleasing him to kind of end this war, stop the killing. On the other hand, Europe is afraid of him invading Estonia or Lithuania or whatever other small European country. So he is in a very, very powerful position right now, and maybe actually the most powerful position any Russian president has been for the last decades after the end of the Cold War. So I don't really see any motivation for him to end this, because as soon as he is doing or he's ending this in any way that is not showing off Russia's power, he is actually the loser of this whole conflict, right?
Well, I don't agree with that at all. Number one, an endless war is never to the interest of a political leader. Your political support drains away. And that's especially true if the rest of the world offers you quite acceptable terms for ending the war. If he ended the war on the terms that Trump was offering him, he would be viewed as a hero, right? Previously, the Americans had said they will never accept an arrangement that involves the cession of Ukrainian territory. They will never agree that Ukraine will not be a member of NATO. Trump is giving them all that stuff. That would be viewed as a huge victory by the Russian elite. It would increase Putin's popularity. The whole argument about enabling Russia to reintegrate itself in the community of civilized nations, doing away with all these sanctions and threatened prosecutions and all this kind of thing. It's very much in Russia's interest. Russia does not like to be treated like a pariah country, right? Here we have Trump threatening, if Russia refuses these very reasonable terms that are on offer, that there will now be secondary sanctions, secondary boycotts of Russian goods. We'll penalize India and China for trading with Russia, for buying Russian oil. And so Putin cannot look on that as no problem there. You know, so he's being offered something that's obviously in Russia's interest and in his own personal interest, I think. And the alternative of the consequences of not accepting that offer and having this war go on indefinitely and having Russia become more of a pariah state, having America kind of drive the wedge between Russia and both India and China, any intelligent Russian is going to say, take the deal, wrap it up. You know what it kind of reminds me of? It's during the Kennedy period, when Nikita Khrushchev was the Soviet leader. Kennedy, despite all of his rhetoric about we will bear any burdens and so on, Kennedy was realpolitiker. He wanted to settle the Cold War on what for the Soviet Union would have been perfectly acceptable terms. We recognize the status quo in Europe. We recognize the division of Germany. We recognize the status quo in Berlin, so on. We're willing to meet the USSR's number one security concern, namely the control of German power, because we will force West Germany to abandon its nuclear aspirations. And to the point where Kennedy was willing to have this extraordinary showdown with the Germans in 1963, and it led to the forced departure of Konrad Adenauer from the chancellorship under American pressure, right? These are big concessions that the Americans were making to the Russians in order to get them, for their part, to accept the status quo in Central Europe and thus to end the Cold War. All we asked is that they accept our presence in West Berlin. And to the amazement and of the Kennedy people, Khrushchev refuses to do that. Right? That's the meaning of the Cuban Missile Crisis, by the way. It's not about the Caribbean. It's not about Cuba. It's about this crisis that was developing in Europe. If you look at the memoirs of the Soviet ambassador to the United States during that whole later Cold War period, Anatoly Dobrynin, he can't believe that Khrushchev turned his back on that American offer. He said, it would have been the greatest success conceivable for Soviet diplomacy. But part of the problem is that there's a certain logic to bargaining. When countries make concessions, it doesn't necessarily bring a deal closer, because the other side would say, oh, look, they're making concessions. That shows how eager they are for a settlement. That shows how weak they are and how afraid they are of war. So let's tighten our position. Let's harden our position. We'll get more. We'll shake the tree a bit more, and more goodies will fall out of the tree. Right? Very foolish policy on Khrushchev's part. And similarly, it led to his fall. You know, the whole policy of confrontation with America, which led to the Cuban Missile Crisis, which on our part was, we took a hard line in the Cuban Missile Crisis because he had threatened us with a showdown around Berlin, and we wanted to have it out with them while we still had nuclear superiority. All very clear from the documents, not that anyone reads these things. We were willing to have that showdown with them over Central Europe, basically, and the Soviets are forced to back down during the Cuban Missile Crisis, and that led to Khrushchev's fall. Well, if you were looking for historical analogs, it's the same thing could happen with Putin. He's not there. He's not a total free agent. There are forces within the whole Russian national security establishment and within the Russian population that have to be taken into account. And once it becomes known that he could have very good terms and that the alternative of continuing the war would just lead to a disaster and maybe to his own personal fall from power, you think that sooner or later he would have to give way. But, I mean, as I say, what I'm doing here is I don't know too much about what goes on within Russia. I'm just speculating on the basis of my whole sense for how international politics works. And, you know, we will see in the next couple of months whether this war has ended. But these people that you were talking to who make the argument of, oh, I don't understand, he's an irrational dictator, he's a crazy man, he's a Russian imperialist and so on. If they're right, this war is going to go on forever, right? If I'm right, the war is going to be ended within the next year, all right? So you can have me back on your program, and you can play this clip saying, Trachtenberg says the war is going to be over by December 31st, 2020-25. Let's see if he's right. Well, I'll come back even if I'm wrong. So you see what I'm saying?
Sure. Don't get me wrong. That would be my preferred solution to this whole conflict if we find a solution till the end of the year and the war is just ended. Like, I would be the first who would throw a big party on that. But if we look back at the annexation of Crimea by Russia, do you think we would have had a chance to react differently and prevent the escalation that led to the war in Ukraine?
Oh, well, I mean, when you look at the Obama policy on Ukraine, it was a total outrage. This, you know, this whole business of Victoria Nuland, you know, she was what, Assistant Secretary of State for European Affairs or whatever it was. She goes over, she encourages the demonstrators. In fact, some of them were quite violent in Kiev. A very deep intervention in internal Ukrainian politics to put our people in charge. Someone, probably Russian intelligence, actually eavesdropped on her conversation with the U.S. ambassador in Kiev. His name was Jeffrey Piat, and they posted the tape of that conversation online. You can listen to this thing, and it's basically they're pulling the strings about who should be in power in Ukraine. United States was intervening in very deeply in internal Ukrainian affairs, knowing that this would outrage Russia, as indeed Russian intervention in Mexico or whatever would outrage us. Right? And so you have Obama, who I thought was in favor of a low-profile, low-key foreign policy. He finds out about this stuff. She's not even disciplined. She's not even fired from her job. He could have said, this is outrageous. We respect Russia's interests as a great power. We are not going to have semi-official agencies of the American government or even official agencies intervening in Ukrainian affairs to the extent they have. You know about the National Endowment for Democracy? Trump just got rid of it, but it was this terrible thing. It was this bipartisan thing for intervening in the internal affairs of other countries. You know, promoting democracy as the Americans understand it, promoting liberal institutions, right? And that meant, in the case of Ukraine, supporting a deep intervention in internal Ukrainian politics with the goal, according to the director of the NED, called Gershman, of using Ukraine as a kind of springboard for promoting democracy within Russia itself, which is to say, bringing down the Putin regime. Say, did the United States have to pursue that sort of policy? If Russia is a great military power, are you going to poke the bear through the bars of the cage when those bars are bent? Right? Do you want to encourage the Ukrainians, with all this talk of America will stand by you, to mistreat the Russian-speaking minority within their own country, right? I should say, did you ever hear of the notion of moral hazard? This is a concept that was actually developed in the insurance industry to say, well, if people have insurance against mishaps, they're going to be less careful about preventing the mishaps in the first place. Say, NATO is a form of insurance. We're insuring these countries, former constituent republics of the Soviet Union, against Russian attack. We're saying, if Russia attacks you, we'll defend you. And then they say, oh, America's going to defend us. Oh, we can do whatever we want. Say, doesn't matter. 40% ethnic Russian minority in your country. Well, we'll mistreat them. We'll not give them their language rights, their cultural rights, and so on, because Russia can't do anything about it because America protects us, right? The Americans could have been much more sensitive to things like that, to the moral hazard problem, to the problem that Russia may be weak now, but it's a great power with enormous resources. It's bound to revive sooner or later. And then what will we do? Don't we want to get along with this country? Trump comes along and says, we want to get along with Russia. This is the first time 8 years ago. The whole national security establishment, head of the CIA, head of the director of national intelligence, but especially Brannan, but also Clapper. They say, we can't allow this guy to pursue those policies. He has no right, simply because he was elected president, to break with the policies, these liberal internationalist policies that the United States has been pursuing from the start. So we're going to make sure that he can't do it by ensnaring him in all these charges of collusion with Russia and so on. By the way, this whole business of the collusion with Russia, what was Trump accused of? Of encouraging the Russians and of entering into conspiracy with the Russians to intervene in our election by hacking into the email accounts of Hillary Clinton's top assistants, like John Podesta, so that we can find out what Hillary Clinton was saying in secret to these people like Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley and so on, these big investment bankers that she refused to release in public. So they hacked into John Podesta's account and they released what Hillary Clinton was saying, and this was damaging to Hillary. Now, in the old days, the American press would say, that's great. The public has a right to know. Hillary could be the president. If she's embracing policies of like open borders that are at odds with what the bulk of the American people want, we have a right to know that, right? So this was the attitude of the New York Times and the Washington Post at the time of the Pentagon Papers. The main American newspapers were willing to break the law by colluding with Daniel Ellsberg to release classified information, right? Not a problem in those days. They were great champions of democracy and of the public's right to know. But the public didn't have a right to know about what Hillary was saying in private. And if Trump encouraged the Russians to release this information, well, that's an outrage. It shows that he's a puppet of Putin. You see what I'm saying? The standards are constantly shifting depending on whose ox is gored, depending on whose political interests are served. So these people entered into what we now know was a conspiracy to undermine Trump's first presidency with the goal of preventing him from pursuing a Russia-friendly policy. That did not have to be. Trump could have destroyed these people by arguing more effectively against them. All sorts of alternative policies were possible. At any point, I think, different policies that could have been pursued that would have avoided the war, up to the very eve of the war. You know, about the peace negotiations on the eve of the war and during its very first phase. But the Americans and the other Western countries encouraged the Ukrainians to take a very hard line, as I say, on the whole issue of NATO expansion, on the whole issue of the cession of territory like Crimea, on the whole issue of the rights of the ethnic Russian minority within Ukraine, The policy they pursued was a policy that played a very fundamental role in leading to the war, and that policy could obviously have been very different.
So you would agree with Donald Trump when he's saying that that whole war wouldn't have started if he would have gotten his second term right away?
Well, we don't know what the answer to that question is. If Trump had gotten his second term and he had been able to defeat the forces within the government that had been arrayed against him, yes, he could have avoided. He could have made a deal with Putin. I don't know if that would have been possible, though, at that particular point, given the whole campaign to hamstring the Trump foreign policy. The other thing about Trump is, don't forget, this guy, he has no background whatsoever in this area. And the people he is with, they don't have any background. The Trump, when he talks about Ukraine and makes this argument that Russia would never have invaded if I had been president, he makes two totally inconsistent arguments. One is the argument they never would have done it because I realized that we were pursuing a provocative policy and I would have changed that policy and I would have ruled out NATO expansion and so on. But he also makes the argument they never would have done it because they're afraid of me. They know how violent I could be. They know that I was the one who gave javelins to Ukraine. He says that all the time. He says, I was the one who had the tougher line about Ukraine than Obama had. Right? Obama had ruled out javelins. I gave Ukraine javelins. So he doesn't think things through, right? So you're never quite sure which way he's going to come down on any of these issues. So if he had won re-election the first time 4 years ago, I don't know what would have happened. It's possible war could have been avoided. It's also possible you would have had the war anyway. But the point is that he was defeated. He had 4 years to think about all this stuff. To think about how his presidency had been, his first presidency had been hamstrung, paralyzed by what they call the deep state, the permanent officials who would not allow Trump to pursue the Russia-friendly policy that he had wanted to pursue. And now he was going to take very rapid action and get rid of all those people and make sure that all the documents came out that revealed exactly what they had done. In other words, he went on the offensive. I don't think he could have done that if he had been reelected 4 years ago, but he was able to do it this time. So, and frankly, it makes things much, much more interesting for people like me that he's had a chance to kind of show what he could do when he has the power to do it. Another important change, by the way, has to do with the political situation within the United States. 4 years ago, the Republicans in the Congress who were against Imperial America, people like J.D. Vance, who wanted to disengage from Ukraine and so on, they were a minority among the Republicans. What Trump did during the last 4 years was to seize control of the Republican Party so that the entire Republican contingent in both the House and in the Senate are now Trump supporters. Why is that? Because he has developed a political movement in the United States which will challenge these people in their primaries if they don't support the Trump policy. So he has a much freer hand politically to do what he wants to do now and has had 4 years to stew in his resentments about what had happened the first time to take very active measures now. So he's able to do things now that he wouldn't have been able to do if he had been reelected. Whether things would have reached the point where he could have avoided the war to begin with, I don't know. But what can you say? The past is what it is. You can't undo it. And it's interesting to see what he's doing now and whether his actions will be effective.
All right. So then let's wait and see what's going to happen in the next couple of weeks and months. And, well, I hope that you are right in the end and we will see an end to this whole conflict by the end of the year. That would be like a best case scenario, I would say. But at the same time, it depends on the terms. So not any deal is a good deal. So let's see how this turns out. But thank you so much for taking the time and for those, very interesting answers.
Well, it was my pleasure being with you, Daniel. And maybe we'll do this again sometime, after the turn of the year. We'll see what happens. Okay. Definitely. So thanks. Thanks very much. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. Did you enjoy the episode? Follow us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you prefer listening to your favorite podcast shows. Forward Thinkers is a 48 Forward podcast produced in the 48 Forward Studios in Munich.